Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Mobius Door by Andrew Nyberg. Narrated by Brian Telestai. Chapter 1. The Boy Who Discovered the Door. Stuart. It was mid-afternoon in late July. Back in town, most of the kids swam in the Millwood Community Pool, roamed the corridors of the Pine Grove Mall, or attempted to consume the 8 to 12 scoops of a medium Hayward's ice cream cone before it became a puddle for the ants. More so than any other time of the year, parents were content to remain in their air-conditioned offices and retail jobs. A fact poorly recognized outside the Northeast is that humidity during a New England summer easily exceeds 100%. In the woods, a boy named Stuart sweated through his t-shirt from shoulder to shoulder and down to his shorts. He huffed and puffed, wiping his forehead with damp forearms, swapping forearm sweat for forehead sweat, and vice versa, smearing dirt all over. To anyone devoted to cleanliness, his condition would be abject misery. As Stuart was far from devoted to cleanliness, he was quite happy. He gathered fallen branches from a recent storm to add to his fort, while in the company of no fewer than three of his best imaginary friends. Other imaginary friends came and went, but these were the bedrocks with whom he played many ongoing stories that made time alone more adventuresome. So it was that this squad arrived with a bundle of sticks at what the boy thought of as the clearing, which was really just a spot without much undergrowth. At the edge of the clearing stood the fort that, to the boy, served as a besieged jungle outpost, a medieval keep, or a colony in the Proxima Centauri system. Because Stuart lacked a hammer, nails, or any other relevant tools, the fort was a sorry affair, little more than branches heaped in a rectangle, though its southern side did possess a decent view of a babbling brook that housed frogs and crawfish. It took imagination to see the fort as the rampart he did. It was certainly a fixer-upper, but Stuart, like most boys in summer, had plenty of time for fixing and upping. Moreover, what mattered most to Stuart was that the fort was his and his alone. He'd ventured deep into the woods to ensure that none of the jerks from the high school could batter it down when they took stolen six-packs onto the trails. No matter how much he begged, Stuart's little brother wasn't allowed more than three blocks from home, and Stuart's mom wouldn't come this deep to meet the Virgin Mary. Well, not a marvel of engineering, the fort was well designed to give the boy a place of his own, at least until the next big storm. Stuart set his burden down as his imaginary friends settled into their duties. One propped his foot up on a stump and surveyed the trees with camouflage binoculars, while another checked the breech of his weapon before inspecting his barrel. The third crouched down and unslung the radio pack to establish comms with HQ. Their hike from where Stuart chained his bike at the trailhead had been quiet, but the partisans could have laid their ambushes anywhere. With the perimeter set, construction naturally fell to Stuart as the only soldier capable of manipulating physical reality. From the bundle of branches, he dragged the fattest and longest branch, one that would make a good crossbar, and raised it into place. The structure shuddered, and a couple of smaller branches clattered to the ground. An acorn fell from its little acorn hat, bounced off a rock, and tumbled to a stop against the boy's foot. His attention caught between the trunks of two voluminous pines. There stood a door. A simple door. Oak, maybe? Pine? He didn't know the different kinds of wood. He also didn't know how he'd missed the door before, though no one could say for certain that the door had actually been there before he saw it, or that, despite looking every bit like a door once consciously registered, it looked like a door at all before that moment. Perhaps the door only resembled a door after it was recognized as such. Humans have never been good at identifying effects that precede their causes. In the end, who's to say how and when unexplained doors arrive? The door so intrigued the boy that he scarcely noticed that the crossbar had slipped and clattered to the dirt. He stepped around the stick heaps toward the two intervening pines and then skirted around them, too. The soldiers ceased to be because Stuart forgot to keep imagining them. His feet no longer needed conscious instruction to carry him forward until he stood within reach of the knob. His tongue slipped from his mouth and tasted sweat from the peach fuzz below his nose. The door stood in the wood, and so did the boy. The boy staring at the door. The door doing nothing other than being a door, and being shut, because that's about the extent of what doors do when not being opened. If the boy pondered for a moment what lay beyond a door that seemingly opened to the forest beyond, then one might also entertain whether the door wondered what lay beyond the boy. Then, the boy did what one would expect of a boy of middle school age confronted with an unexplained, freestanding door in the middle of the woods. He turned the knob and opened the door. Back in Millwood, a man named Percy Weaver pushed open the door to Colin's old-fashioned cuts and waved to Colin, who was giving a woman a sharp line of bangs. Officer Douglas McCorville closed and locked the cell door in the station, incarcerating a drifter he'd picked up behind the Denny's. At the Exxon on the corner of Shelley and Capra, Heather Bradley, Stuart's mother, opened the door of her vehicle, then popped the gas tank door of her hail-battered Hyundai Sonata. In each case, the door involved did what doors do in the way that doors do them. The door in the woods opened to nothing but blackness. Stuart's hand fell from the knob. A few birds sang their afternoon song. A squirrel leapt from a stout branch on one tree to a thin and pliant branch on another. A trio of leaves puffed off the vibrating branch and drifted groundward. Stuart took a single step back and grunted a simple, "Huh." He ran one hand across his forehead and down his cheek, leaving a long streak of grime. "Huh," the boy grunted again. As he gazed into the blackness within the frame, nothing rational or conscious passed through his thoughts. His eyes shifted like someone in REM sleep, tackling different pinpoints across the utterly smooth surface before him. It was almost impossible to process just how black the darkness was. A YouTube video had taught Stuart about artists fighting over who had made the blackest black, but they had nothing on this. Like peering into a Pacific trench, one had the sense that the depth would never end. It bears noting that this darkness never did. Stuart certainly had no idea what to make of it. He rubbed his eyes and shook his head. He flexed one knee, then the other. Unsure what to do next, the boy reached for the edge of the door to pull it shut. His hand hesitated halfway when he realized there was no knob on the inside, not even a screwed-on plate or recessed bolt. Then he grabbed the door and swung it shut. The door slowed right before it banged home, easing into place with the softest of clicks. While perhaps an adult might have treated the door and the darkness within with considerable alarm, Stuart's apprehensions were counterbalanced by curiosity. He felt like he'd witnessed a magic trick. Stuart reached for the knob again, never having seen anything like that darkness. Donning his best imaginary scientist hat, he figured himself on a distant planet studying an alien artifact. He needed to gather data and observations before he could draw a meaningful hypothesis. His mind conjured up his biology teacher, and he smiled as if to say Mr. Wexler would be proud. The boy brushed his palms on his pants to wipe off the sweat, only slightly registering that his skin was bone dry. Despite how humid the day had been, despite how much he'd sweated, every bit of moisture was gone from the exterior of his body. Even the inside of his cheeks and throat felt a bit parched. He considered jogging to his bicycle to retrieve the water bottle from the frame-mounted holster, maybe even the fig bars from the little pouch underneath the seat. But he had a different thirst to sate first. Stuart decided to observe the door from all angles, so he began to circle the frame, eyes running up and down the surfaces. He took in all the expected curves and swirls of wood grain, the periodic knot. It struck him that he couldn't identify seams where pieces of wood came together. Apparently, the whole frame had been carved from a single source. A quarter into his intended circuit, he froze. He chewed his lip and knitted his eyebrows. There was a knob on the back side of the door. "What the hell?" Stuart asked. Not only was there a knob, but there were hinges as well. It was indeed notable about this door that, when closed, one side was literally indistinguishable from the other. Were he truly a scientist rather than a boy pretending to be one, he might have noticed that the wood grain was itself identical on both faces. It never occurred to him to take it another step further and wonder if both sides of the door were actually the same side. He might have then considered which side of the door, were it opened, would be considered indoors or outdoors. Perhaps the whole of the world was one or the other. Nevertheless, Stuart was faced with two mutually exclusive observations. When the door was opened, there was a knob on only one side. But when it was shut, there were knobs on both. In an effort to confirm the paradox, he opened the door a second time and discovered, again, that when opened, the knob was only on one side. He closed the door again and walked back to where he'd begun. There it was, saying clear as day, "Hey, I'm a knob on this side of the door." For his part, the boy summed it up in the way that only a boy could. "Neat!" Having established through repeated experimentation this initial observation, it naturally became time to study the darkness itself. The door was fascinating, but it was not the most striking phenomenon present. Something primal guided his hand back to the knob. Heather. Heather Bradley pulled her car into the driveway, reached up, and pressed the button on the garage door opener clipped to the visor. On the stereo, almost too low to distinguish, played screaming Jay Hawkins' "I Put a Spell on You." What was the DJ thinking playing such a garish song? She turned the stereo off as she watched her garage door trundle up its rails. Heather pulled forward between the family bikes and shelving buried in overflowing boxes. An unfurled child's party favor dangled limply over the edge of a cobwebbed bag of pointed hats and Skylander napkins. The floor-to-ceiling collection in the Bradleys' garage might imply that Heather was a hoarder. But she would rebut that she didn't hoard. She simply held on. After all, the rest of the house was near spotless. She put the car into park, turned off the AC, and killed the engine. When she exited the vehicle, she didn't notice the spot in the bike tangle where her oldest son's black mountain bike with the lightning bolt reflectors should have been. If anything, a tiny part of her mind buzzed that there might be a little more space to hold on to something else. She smoothed her palms on the pleats of her skirt and flexed her fingers before she slipped the keys into her purse and entered the mudroom, a 3-foot nook at the back of the kitchen where the door resided, along with a bristly brown mat and a line of shoes. Like the missing bike, she also failed to register that the shoe line should have hosted an additional pair by this hour, less than an hour before the family's official dinner time. She set her work shoes beside her casual sneakers and hung her purse on the back of a chair at the kitchen table. She removed her earrings and adjusted the cuffs of her blouse before unclasping a thin banded watch with a silver face and set the adornments in a china bowl on the counter. Her steps carried her to the foyer and the base of the stairs, where she rested her hand on the banister post and called up the stairs,
"Stu! Micah!"
Now, were her home in proper order, the thumping of two pairs of feet should have followed. Two doors should have shut at approximately the same time, and the both of her children should have broken into view. This afternoon, only one pair of feet hit the floor, only one door shut, only one face, the face of her younger son, Micah, appeared past the edge of the second-story hall at the stair top. Heather's smile slipped at the edges, but didn't fade completely. She hadn't reached a threshold of serious concern. Stuart was occasionally out biking upon her return. The conditions for alarm had not yet been met. However, the combination of absences, the bike, the shoes, and the boy, nettled a little spot of her thoughts. Perhaps this is why the next words she spoke towards the face tilted down the stairs were, "Hello, dear. Where is your brother?" Stuart. The boy, the brother in question, Stuart, his given name, pondered a question of a different sort. With the door open, he found himself unable to walk in a circle around it. His feet would move. The gyroscopic feedback system of his inner ears told him he was moving. But the door seemed fixed in place, and the landscape around it didn't move with him. It felt more like the distance he traveled was distance traveled from himself, and his head started to swim and buzz like it was full of drowning bees. Normally, he would sooner pull a muscle than give up on a physical task, but this was light years different, and all he had wanted was to see how the hinges worked on the far side when the door was already open. Stopping brought instant relief, so complete that he entirely forgot what had bothered him and resumed his gaze into the blackness. From the boy's perspective, it looked both as thin as surface tension and as endless as the space between the dimmest stars. It occurred to him that maybe he'd discovered something important. For the second time, he considered returning to his bicycle, but this time to ride home and call someone. NASA, maybe? Or the president? Did they even have phone numbers? Maybe he should call his science teacher, or the police chief? Of all the people he could think of, they seemed most likely to have the heft to get a hold of NASA or the president. He even considered telling his parents. In fact, the thought of the boy's parents almost caused him to throw the door shut and run from the woods. If he left that instant, he would definitely make it back for dinner and avoid the grounding that would result from tardiness. Had the boy closed the door, it would be conceivable that nothing further would have come of it. The boy may not have returned, or the door may not have been there if he did. Perhaps left with no one to establish its doorness, the door would cease being a door. Perhaps this story would simply be told. A boy found a mysterious door in the woods. He opened it and found darkness, so he shut it, told no one, and lived an uneventful life until he passed in his sleep of old age. Unfortunately for Stuart, human beings are peculiar in that what is definite does not always seem as likely as what is possible. Poor people shell out scrounged cash for lotteries to possibly pay all their bills rather than definitely pay some of them. Workers the world over procrastinate paid projects because they can probably finish them in less than the designated time. A couple in our very own Millwood devoted all their extra resources into building a 2,000-square-foot underground shelter because of, maybe, nukes, meteors, or supervolcanoes. To the mind of this particular boy, even if he stayed a few more minutes, he could probably hustle back in time. This boy did not die in his sleep of old age. Dinner approached. The door examination needed to accelerate to experimentation. Stuart bent over at the waist and looked about his feet until he found a nice, palm-sized rock. He tossed the rock in the air about 6 inches, the quartz trapped within it, catching the light, and he caught it with the same hand that tossed it. That arm then cocked back and snapped forward. The rock departed from the boy's palm. No overcoming oppositional force acted on it to divert its path. One could assert that this was the last moment that the laws of physics could be said to truly apply to the universe. The rock disappeared into the darkness without the slightest disturbance to its surface. The boy listened and did not hear the stone crash into the bushes on the far side. For just a moment, nothing seemed to happen at all as the result of the rock missile. For just a moment. Micah. For just a moment, Micah stared down the steps at his mother up the steps at her son. Picture this moment in time slowing down, the infinitesimal flux of muscle fibers in Heather Bradley's hand on the head of the banister post, the quiver at the corners of Micah's lips as his mouth prepared to articulate something. The little boy's honest answer would be harmless, given that dinner was not yet set, and thus laying no fault on his brother. However, it still felt like tattling. Picture a single pore on Micah's neck widening and closing, working like a gasping bellows, the skin stretched and contracted. To a microbe, it would resemble Charybdis, pulsing, swallowing, until a bead of liquid, salt, grease, and innumerable toxins in minuscule quantities bulged from the gap. Then, picture a thousand pores doing so in concert all over this little brother's body. It's been postulated that the rancidness of human sweat is a vestigial, primitive defense mechanism in which fear caused us to stink like we were diseased. Micah feared his mother's wrath, so he squeaked,
"Is Stuart going to get into trouble?"
Heather gave her little boy her best sympathetic smile and climbed the steps. She sat on the top stair and patted the runner beside her. Micah swallowed and took a seat. Of course, any child with a sibling knows he was about to be invited to betray his brother. Doing so would score mommy points that would be forgotten the moment he made a mistake himself and cost him brother points that would take weeks to rebuild. However, outside exceptional circumstances, mommy points maintained a superior exchange rate. It was chocolate cake with sprinkles to vanilla ice cream.
"Well, that depends, honey," Heather said. "If he's late, but if he told you where he went, we can pick him up in time."
It was tempting reasoning, a well-laid mommy trap. It was like being asked to admit he'd been lying about having homework. She would tell him if he came clean, he wouldn't get to watch TV but would still get dessert, and that he'd get neither if she searched his book bag and room. For the latter, there was always the chance he'd get away with it, just like it was possible that Stuart could still get home in time. If they went and found him, he'd be in trouble regardless. Heather rested a hand on Micah's shoulder.
"If you know where your brother is," she said, "you need to tell me."
Micah nodded. Things had escalated. It was lie or fess up. And he'd be on the hook if Stuart ratted him out to lessen his own punishment. All it would take was for Stuart to plead,
"But I told Micah to tell you where I was,"
and the shackles of a grounding would clamp down. Micah took a long breath.
"He rode his bike to the woods."
Heather Bradley, for her part, rolled her eyes.
"Christ on a school bus," she said. "One of these days he's going to break an ankle in those woods, and I'm sure it's spring rain that he forgot his watch. You get yourself ready. I'm going to put together the lasagna. Then we'll go pick his little butt up."
Stuart. The boy had, of course, forgotten his watch, not at home, but that the thing on his wrist might have been built by aliens for angels for all the awareness he held towards it. His eyes fixated on where the rock had vanished. The stillness of the moment, the same moment his brother sold him out, was so brief that Stuart's heart managed no more than a single lub. Then, at the exact spot where the rock vanished into the darkness, the tiniest circular ripple spread. No more than a couple millimeters high, the ring swept across the surface in a flash
until one of its edges reached the frame. With the instant of contact with the wood, the whole ring ceased moving. At this point, dub. Darkness poured from the door like sand from a bucket with a hole in the side. The stream began exactly as wide in diameter as the rock, and the darkness struck the ground and accumulated, not quite like sand or liquid, but growing in volume. The base of the pile rose over exposed roots, swallowed leaves and other debris. The bore widened to the width of a softball. All this while the boy was doing something that, given the uncertainty of whether it was possible to close the door at this point, was quite understandable. He was backing away. However, with most of his attention fixed on the door and the darkness, he failed to notice the crook between stones into which his foot slipped, causing the subsequent fracture of his ankle. Were the boy much older and accustomed to pain, his situation might not have become definitively catastrophic. Adrenaline and determination may have propelled him as he crawled over tree trunks and around rocks, even as he vomited and wept from agony. The boy, however, dealt with his pain in a young boy's manner. He grabbed hold of his leg and screamed. His eyes clenched tight against tears, and his ankle throbbed far worse than anything he'd ever felt. The world had become white, pulsing light. When he did finally get hold of his pain, the darkness was pouring into the world with increasing rapidity, as if under great pressure, the way a bore in an earthen dam widens as the torrent sluices through. It was nearly upon the boy when his eyes reopened, already barreling over him, when his vision cleared enough to register the wall of darkness. The word, "Mommy," died on his lips. For a moment, he saw his imaginary friends standing in a semicircle behind him. They reached out, their non-existent hands offering the last reassurance the boy would ever receive. Then, their faces thinned and withered. Their lips peeled back from their teeth, and their eyes sunk into their skulls. Their flesh shriveled and blotched, rolling back like burning parchment. Instinct took control of the boy's body, and he lurched to his feet to turn and run. This was not the right thing to do. His ankle broke further, and, with a shriek, the boy pitched over like he'd been flung. His temple struck a pointy rock, and the boy left this world before the darkness embraced him. Now, in the moments after his death, as the darkness engulfed the boy's body, something living within the darkness, something right at the expanding edge, something desperate to move as far from the door as it could, entered the boy's body through the heel just as the darkness rolled over the still foot. The boy's body twitched, first in the extremities and then the deeper muscles as its new driver learned to fire the necessary synapses. A hand lifted from the ground and opened and closed. Toes curled as far as almost outgrown shoes allowed. The new entrant into his physiology detected the damage to the ankle, multiple fractures, and surged the body's energy to repair. Bone mended, and re-knitting capillaries pulled the bruise straight from the tissue. Swollen sinew shrank to normality, and the joint flexed as it should. The heartbeat, then again, falling into rhythm. The body sat up within the still growing darkness. Its eyes opened. Unlike the being who had steered the vessel before, the visitor could see in the darkness, though what it saw exceeds the boundaries of our language. It wasn't until it rose the body to its feet and pulled itself free from the darkness and into the light that the blindness struck. Thankfully, for the visitor, this blindness was being overwhelmed by new input. It had never known the world's light, but the vessel's biology was designed to process the data. Vision began as a dazzling color blur that sharpened into shapes. shapes reconciled into foreign forms, but the information stored in the cerebral synapse.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?